In this episode of the Music Folder, we have a great chance to host Jeff Mills. Welcome, Jeff. He is considered more than an icon in techno music. He started in Detroit in the 1980s and today is recognized for his ability to transport techno beyond the dance floor. In fact, thanks to his transdisciplinary approach, techno music is able to dialogue with cinema, with art, with fashion, and with different styles of music. In other words, techno, according to his vision, is the genre of music that is able to interpret the complexity of space and time we are living in. It's always a great pleasure to have the opportunity to exchange ideas with you, Jeff. And I'd like to start our conversation with an anecdote. Going back in time, I remember when I first saw a screening of Metropolis, the Fritz Lang's cult film from 1927, with your soundtrack. It was 2004 in Bologna at Link, and in the afternoon, Metropolis was screened and Cinemix was presented. And in the evening, you were playing with Underground Resistance, presenting Timeline. There was also Mike Banks, among others. It was such a special event. I still remember the reaction of the audience. This was astonishing. Everyone was wondering how you got that idea and how you arranged to create that music. And now the release of a new soundtrack called Metropolis, Metropolis, three vinyl set for Axis. I was thinking, at that time, did you already know that it wasn't going to be the final version of Metropolis?
I remember that event and that time. I thought then that I would only, have to address the film only once, as with the other films that I've created soundtracks for. I just assumed that one soundtrack would be sufficient, would be enough to address the very important social and economic messages that Metropolis and Fritz Lang, use film for to relate to the public. And so, at the time, I just didn't think that I would have to or would like to revisit the film.
So more than 20 years later comes the new Metropolis soundtrack you call the Metropolis Metropolis. And I think there is an emphasis more on the relationship that humans have to establish with machines, with technology, because it's not the technology that is raging against us as much as the use that humans make of it. Indeed, machines would be there to, in a way, to rescue us as a human race. Can you tell us how you relate to this new version of Metropolis?
There is a connection between the first version and this version. What I did not want to do was to revisit the soundtrack. I wanted to revisit the film, but not the soundtrack, the style and the direction and the texture, certain characteristics of the first soundtrack. Instead, what I wanted to do was to continue and to add on and to expand from the first soundtrack. So imagine part one, part two of the same story. So I just didn't feel that it was really necessary to recreate those type of tracks. So what I did instead was to come up with the idea to create a deeper version, assuming that since the first soundtrack, people that might have bought that or might have became aware of it from that first soundtrack, seen the movie, imagining that they've seen it back in 2000, and some of it kind of stayed and remained in their memory, or they've kind of came across the film at some point over the past 20 years, and that they have matured also, and they have experienced the same things that I have, all the activity and the issues pressing in the world since, you know, 20 years. And so we arrive at a soundtrack that addresses our growth and at the point that we are at since the first soundtrack. So it's a continuation. And as I was composing it, I was assuming that the sounds and certain tracks in the first version would stayed in the memory or stayed in the mind of the listener. And so this new soundtrack is not a supplement, but it's an addition onto that. Mm-hmm. And so I could explore much, much deeper structurally and dimensionally with this soundtrack. So I felt it wasn't necessary to compose the music literally, but in a very mosaic approach to what Metropolis is as a message to society. It doesn't run in the same order as the film. It does not speak to any specific scene specifically, but it kind of navigates around the sentiment in which the viewer might have from watching such a scene, for instance, Maria preaching to her congregation, or her dancing in front of, an audience, it's a soundtrack that is from the perspective of more of the person watching it or listening to the soundtrack. Mm-hmm. So there's no breaks. The music is all continuous because that's how I feel life is, you know. It doesn't give you a break. It's one event after the next, and it just seems like it never stops, whatever that is. So there's no silence in the soundtrack at all. And it sometimes is suspenseful, sometimes it's very dramatic, sometimes it's a transition. Sometimes my intention was to give the listener a rest to make them ponder and think about what they just heard. So that sound isn't necessarily a composition, or it wasn't designed to make you recognize anything. It was designed to give you reflection on what you just heard, or to kind of put you in a position for what you're about to hear. So it's a very unique way of using sound and using music towards cinema. And again, it's a soundtrack that was designed for someone who knows the film or knows a little bit about the film and that has experienced a lot of situations over the past 20 years.
Which is the possibility of the mute cinema of the origin to be continuous without a break. Is a specific way to do soundtrack when you don't have breaks, because there is no dialogue. So it's like to be in a kind of atmosphere. You wrote as a clue that is not a kind of transcription into sound, from sound to images, but it is a way to illustrate the possibility that exists as affinity between imageries that are very distant from each other, like man versus machine, classical music against electronic music. So probably in this sense, electronic music you created for this version of Fritzland has this power to reconnect distant imageries, or maybe distant, they can sound distant, but they are not.
I think that or what I was trying to do was to kind of erase this level of understanding about the differences between styles of music, and I was trying very much to create a piece that felt symphonic. Mm-hmm. Even though it was made with electronics and I didn't have any musicians come into my studio, but I was very much trying to search for sounds that would create a type of feeling that would feel as if it was a body of human musicians. And that comes from my experience of actually playing with orchestras and hearing the imperfections of being inside the body of the orchestra, knowing what sounds are late or purposely, are off or have more of a human inflection than others. So my intention was to kind of detach myself from, or detach this project from electronic music, from classical music. I was very much imagining or hoping that the soundtrack would be considered, even in the smallest amount, in the same respect as the film itself. So released in 1927, because of the subject matter of the film has become timeless. Unfortunately, we still have these problems in society, these gaps between. And I was hoping and composing this music in a way that maybe there might be elements that might be relevant 100 years from now. And so whenever I would come across, or I would in composing it, I would do something that would sound too techno or sound too classical, I would erase it.
Okay.
Whenever I would do something that I think that a violinist would do, I would say that would sound too familiar or it would sound like something. I would erase it. And so so what I was looking for was something that it was kind of difficult to describe, something difficult to tag, so that I could distance myself away from the things that we've known, and in hopes that in time, perhaps maybe another generation or another era might find some usage for this soundtrack or can better define it better than we can.
Do you know that last year I decided to show my university students Lang's film Metropolis with your soundtrack, but the one of 2001, of course. And we discussed the film and we analyzed it. And only after a few lessons, I showed them the version with the original music. And it was really surprising, taking account that they are 20 years old university students. And so just a couple of them knew the Metropolis film. In the end, no one of them could any longer imagine the film with the original soundtrack, because what they perceived, really felt in terms of imagery and sound, science fiction of those time, could have no other sound than the one you realize. And I'm talking about the version of 2001. Mm. So, I mean, I was not surprised, but the reaction was so strong about the kind of feeling the strange idea of using classical music for science fiction movies, right, which is still happening in nowadays. I mean, I've always wondered why contemporary science fiction doesn't accept electronic music for the movies.
Well, I think that probably for a few reasons. I think in my opinion and my observation, I think that it's not, it may be explored enough. I wish that there were more electronic music musicians that are using synthesizers and machines in a more orchestrated or not always dance music, not always for the club, not always, but using it in various ways, so that it can be considered more for film. It can be, it can show examples of addressing scenes other than someone dancing. You know, I think it's not just the old three-piece suit executives in Hollywood that are choosing classical music, but it's also from our end as well. It's also inside the industry and the community of producers that make electronic music, perhaps maybe don't explore enough, and they don't use the opportunities that we have, the freedom in electronic music, to create different examples for usage of the genre. So, and I mean, why that is, I'm not quite sure. But I never, speaking personally, I never felt to have this limitation, or I've never felt pressured to only make a certain type of music. Or when I step into my studio, I anything goes. It is really up to my imagination, and how I'm feeling at that moment is what's going to be created. And it doesn't matter who may like it, or if it will sell, or those things. And it's always been like that. And I feel actually there's more fulfillment, actually more personal fulfillment when I'm actually able to exhaust ideas to their fullest form, without any contradiction or any type of confinement to any specific elements. So I think, if we had more examples, if we had more producers trying to compose music or moving to spend a day or a few days or a week or so just fooling around with film and trying to create music for it, we might have more examples, and film studios and directors and people might see these works out. Maybe it takes time. Maybe younger producers listening to this program right now might really hear what I'm saying or what I'm insinuating, that yes, dance music is a large part of electronic music, but there are many other aspects to it that need to be explored. And then when you turn back to dance music, it makes dance music more interesting, because you can cross connect these different styles. And so it just makes it so producers should explore. That should be really the first understanding about creation.
Always talking about your relationship with cinema and music, in here inside Sound and Space, which I love very much, we have the possibility to hear something from the Blade Runner soundtrack that you couldn't finish, the track Deckard. And that film, and before the film, the book by Philip Kendrick Dick, is deeply rooted about the nostalgia of the human. The replicants don't want to be retired, but in the end, despite being violent cyborgs, they demonstrate more humanity and responsibility than humans. I was wondering, what connects you to that film compared to Metropolis? Because there are totally different imageries, eras, and there is the body is totally different body on the scene.
I think more than anything, I think it was that window of influence. You know, I was at a very very sensitive age when I seen Blade Runner for the first time. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was very impactful in high school. And no, I'm sorry. Was that 82? I think
82.
I was out, and I was just becoming more aware of DJ culture and club music. I was a young adult, so I was, I think maybe I was wanting to move out if I had not at that time. And so it had a lot of influence, and it was also the friends, my best friends at the time were all very much into science fiction. So we would have, I remember seeing Blade Runner, and we had just really long conversations about the film that went deep into the night after we'd seen the film. And then we went to go see the film again a few days later, because we had gotten to a discussion about the soundtrack, and I wanted to go into to study it, you know, to hear the soundtrack more, actually. I think I must have seen the film maybe about four or five times during that period. for certain things. I mean, there was the costumes and the special effects, and then I would just go back and just take the afternoon and just see it again, and then again, and it became so ingrained in my memory that I could refer to it in ways because of the connection that I was having with it in my memory. I would remember certain lines. I remember certain quotes. I would remember certain movements of the character. I would remember, for instance, like the dialogue between Rachel and Deckard when he was interviewing her, and the pause in between the questions and the answers, and the, all those things, the amount of light in the room, and Tyrell, and living in a space with just candlelight, and all those type of things were really twisting my brain around in 82, this was, I believe this was before I was on the radio as the Wizard. This was before I began make music. This was before many things had started. And so as I grew older, of course, I seen the film more and more throughout the 80s, of course.
Yeah.
And so it was one of these films that I always thought that it should have a soundtrack that reflected how time is, what we're moving towards.
Yeah.
When the year 2000 came, that was really that really pushed us over this threshold into the new era. And so I thought that now it's time to really start to begin to show examples of what we've been thinking about for decades. For instance, the idea of using electronic music having it scored for classical orchestra was a conversation in Detroit amongst many people, Derek May and Mike Banks, and for many people for a long, long, long time. I mean, having these casual conversations, imagining strings of life with an orchestra was a common conversation, and so it took that long, 80s, 90s, it took about 20 years to get in a position to be able to try to materialize and to put things into action. And so just didn't happen. I mean, I just didn't wake up and go, Blade Runner would be a great film to compose music for. by the time I decided to compose music from, I knew the film literally back and forth. And I think that as even younger, I think that kind of what set me up for that was that I, and also with my friends at the time, we were big comic collectors. So we collected comics, we read them, we made them. We illustrated them when we were kids. We not only illustrated them, but then we created a comic label, and we sold them around the neighborhood. It was just,
wow,
just to see how far we could take it. And this idea of following something and studying something, dissecting something, rethinking it, modifying it, had been there for a long time. And so it went all throughout the 80s with the Wizard and the radio show, with Underground Resistance, through Axis, through Escape Velocity, and just it runs through my whole career, I suppose. And so so this film Metropolis is no different.
In fact, there's a kind of retrofuturistic imagery which really matched with techno music in the 80s. And also, Blade Runner is about memory, is about fake pictures of a past never lived by the replicants. And I was thinking while you were talking that nowadays we are experiencing something different and similar at the same time, about this idea of memory and collecting. All we do is externalize our memories, photographies, messages, emails, music, everything is saved in external memories. What do you think this can represent for our identity? Because the machine remember for us
Right.
instead of us.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean memories, I mean the film had very like Metropolis, you know, had very Blade Runner had very important message about the one element and state of mind that as we grow older and as we age and we increase in numbers with the amount of accumulation of years, memory will become one of the most important things, or things that will provoke memories, will become the most important things, our most valued possessions, basically. So photographs that would allow us, that would provoke us to think of something that happened, a conversation that we once had that made us realize something that was very important, that maybe was a turning point. And our long-term memories are the one most precious thing that we will carry all the way until the end.
Long-term memories.
Yes. And possessions, the most important ones, won't necessarily be based on whether something is expensive or not, or something, whether something has more value or anything like that. They will be based on what will remind you of a time or a place or a person or a feeling that you had when you look at that. And from my view, there won't be many, because people will disappear, places will disappear, your memory will begin to fade, you'll forget things. You'll only remember the things that really made a difference in your life. And I know this because my mother is 92 years old and she has Alzheimer's, and we can see this happening to her. Things that happen all of a sudden don't stay very long in her memory, maybe a day, maybe 24 hours. But she remembers things from many years ago, things that were obviously very important. So the film Blade Runner is, in my opinion, is probably the most important film ever made, because it addresses basically what we're spiraling towards, what we're spinning towards, and what we need to perhaps maybe think about enriching so that we can have more pleasure in as we grow older, and being able to think about and remember things, good and bad, not necessarily always good.
Yes.
So, you know, wisdom, of course, comes along with that, and handing this wisdom down to younger people because you care about them and you don't want them to make the same mistakes is also important. So education is key. Composing music for a film like Metropolis so that younger people and younger generations can be exposed to this film, for example, is, I think, important. Finding ways to do that. You know, the more that we do it, the more we work on our long-term memory.
When you were saying that things will disappear, I was thinking that there are many people that are talking about a new dark age, so to say, the risk that our culture produced in the last century has been archived on media that maybe no longer be readable in the future. So causing this human era, the 20th century in particular, to fall into oblivion. And so have you ever thought about this possibility, and how do you think that we can, I like the fact that we use the word save to save and archive, because it's like really saving something from oblivion, from the lost, from death.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think it's important, but I honestly cannot say that we might be able to hold on to these memories, though, that we might be able to. I mean, we can try. I think we should. But look, I mean, I think that in this new century, in this new age, I think it's better to be more realist than actually, to have a certain amount of realism. Of course, it's important to dream and to be, you know, romantic and try to hope for. But I think it's at times beneficial to be a realist. I mean, it's not written in any, you know, scripture or any book that the world has to be the same as it was before, and that we also don't have to be the same species as we were before, that our evolution could jump not one step, but 10 steps or 50 steps or a million steps forward in an instant. And so I think it's more realistic to not expect or to feel that we are old or that we should feel that we're awarded anything simply because we're just here. And it's probably near impossible for people to imagine and to think this way. And only life-altering events can maybe make us, you know, change the way that we see the world around us. I'm not saying that those won't happen, but it's difficult. It's difficult to imagine that when it's not happening. But I think it's better to imagine that in the future, the world won't be anything like what we're looking at around us right now. And we won't be the same as a result. We will change. And so what we come to expect might be completely different. How do you prepare for something like that? Mm. It helps when you can condition yourself to learn to forget. Mm. I know this is a very dangerous topic, actually. But if one can condition themselves to learn to put aside or to forget things that are perhaps maybe not best within their best interest, for instance, like pain, for instance, or disappointment, or if you can find a way, if you have enough mind power and enough control to target in on what's the real problem and sectionalize or detach that and move that off, and then try to forget about it, then we might have a chance of being able to move forward without being driven crazy by all that's happening around us and such dramatic change. And I say this because 100 years ago, the problems that we're having and we're dealing with today, the same problems were there 100 years ago. So suicide rate was high. People were displaced from agricultural and more hands-on blue-collar jobs were being replaced by machines. Today, the same thing's happening with computers. This era, last century, lasted for about 50 years to around the 1950s. And I suspect probably it might be the same in this century as well. So the computer age might taper off around mid-century and into the next, or preparation for the next industry that will probably climax around towards the end of this century, same as last. And so preparing ourselves, or even thinking that you're preparing yourself, is probably helpful at this point. I think that one, you know, if possible, should try to find a way to be able to get more control over themselves and what they think and what they value as important, and what should stay, what should go, the distance that you have, you know, a normal, comfortable distance that you have between yourself and others, what makes you comfortable, targeting and looking at what makes you uncomfortable, being realistic about the future of things and nature and where things are, again, where we're spiraling and spinning towards. And you have to be honest about that. So if I were to ask a person on the street if they're optimistic about the future, 99% probably would say no, they're not. And they would have very good reason to do that. I think that because we are constantly reminded by all the things that we need to be aware of, in that 1%, you know, has to come the optimism. And that's the percentage that for people like myself, we have to work with to try to inject something into that 1%, to try to expand it, to show the reason why we should be optimistic in the midst of all this, you know, sometimes very chaotic world. So music and sound, film, any of the arts can help with that, if there the intent to, you know, there is an understanding for the common good for that. So, and without that, then you know, it might as well be 100% negativity. I'm not sure.
I think this kind of optimism, I can understand it very well, because it's like, if you are saying that we are living the great opportunity to experience an anthropological mutation where humans are no longer at the center of the world. It's like a kind of surrender to the machines. But once you can get the soul of the machine, this is where I think there is optimism. It's not a struggle. Is a way to find each other's, like if they are others, next to us, not against.
Right. Could yeah. Be. Well, I mean, you know, when you say machine, so far, for now, let's just hypothetically, we are the machine right now. We have control over the machine. Mm-hmm. Whether it'll stay like that, I'm not quite sure. I think there are enough people working towards changing that, where the machine will have its own soul. And when that happens, we have something to compete with. I think there are people that want that to happen. And so in this age of social media and having so much freedom at your fingertips and stuff, it gives the feeling of a certain type of power. But I think we really need to be honest and very real about what we are, where we are, what we're doing, what we're creating, what we're destroying, what is our future as a whole? Not certain groups of people, not rich people, yeah, not poor, but what is our future? And if we could create a perfect world, a utopian, you know, existence, what would that be? Do we even want that? You know, I think by looking at these addressing these questions can then show us where the real problems are, I think. Mm-hmm. But we don't ask those questions enough. We're not given opportunities to ask ourselves these questions. I mean, our world is created that we are always trying to make it better. We have to assume that, you know, Claudia, you know, you and I will spend the rest of our lives trying to make our world better. We will never ever see the point where it is actually better for everyone, unfortunately. So we're part of the 99%, you know. yeah, it's heartbreaking in one way, you know. It's hard to be romantic at times and to stay focused and to think about the future when there's so many things, so many crazy, chaotic things that are happening in the world from hour to hour. But yeah, I don't really know what fuels. I mean, like in Blade Runner, I really, you know, I don't really know what fuels that 1%, you know. Maybe it's, we don't have much of a choice. Maybe we have nothing to lose. Maybe, you know, life is short, so just go for it. Maybe just try to do the best that you can. If it helps anyone, then maybe that was probably worth it. I don't know. Maybe that's the point. Maybe that's how we progress. I don't know. But it's difficult at times. I mean, I use music as an extension of what I think, and I address these projects based on what I think are timely reminders as to at people in electronic music that follow it or that follow the music that I make should be reminded by certain things at certain times to try to rationalize and make sense of certain things. So that's what these projects are about. Whether you like them or not is not really the point. They are created and released and designed to make you think about certain things and hopefully in your long-term memory.
Thank you for what you said. It's very inspiration. Changing topic, I want to come back to the relationship between image and sound, space and time, because it's not only cinema, but also you did that with a painting. I remember the Rembrandt painting that you gave sound to. It was 2015 for other festival in Amsterdam. I thought that was a kind of a very powerful statement because we usually think that music can accompany moving images. But here you give sound to a fixed image, a painting of the 17th century. I remember because I read an interview where you explained the question of lights, the artificial lights of the candle and the natural lights that gave you the inspiration to create sounds coming from different sources. Would you like to explain the process and the reasoning that led you to create this kind of work of sound art, would you call it, or a soundtrack of a painting?
It was I can't remember it was something in meditation. It was
the meditation of philosopher, I think.
The philosopher, philosopher and meditation. What the intention was to, there were a few other projects after the Rembrandt. I think I did Jules Verne. I went to the location where he wrote a lot of his stories. I went to his house, also recorded music in the adjoining room, using the acoustics of that room, and then recorded it from the position of where his head would be. So it's as if so what the listener was hearing was the sound coming from the room next door to where his ears would be as he was sitting at his desk writing the story. Rembrandt was really the first attempt to, I shouldn't say soundscape, but to use the same atmosphere and to use the same elements that Rembrandt might have used for his paintings for a different type of so for music, for instance, to kind of go back and kind of describe exactly what that was. What I did was I went to Amsterdam, went to the house where Rembrandt painted, and it's where students where the school was as well. And I went into the room where he used to paint, and I positioned my equipment and myself at a point so that I could see the light that would normally come through the window that he used for the light on his canvas, and then also separate light from the right side of the room that he used to mix the paints. And so I composed music based on the amount of light at that time of day that would come in, and imagined what that would feel like if he was standing there I was standing behind him as he was there painting next to the fireplace. What I did, I had found that particular painting, Philosopher and Meditation, that had the same situation of light, natural light coming in from the left side and candlelight or a different type of light source coming in from the right side. And the center focus of the painting is the philosopher himself, and that would be Rembrandt. And my perspective would be from looking at the painting, and my perspective from a musician would also be from center point.
Okay.
So you see, it was all connected to that painting, and then also the realization of Rembrandt painting in that room. with the same amount of light. And so so the sound that came out was very interesting. And it was a soundtrack that I never released. I kept it along with the other soundtracks. Perhaps they'll come out at some point. I wanted to do one more. I wanted to do Arthur C. Clarke, to go to Sri Lanka, and to hopefully gain access to where he lived and to try to compose music based on the books that he collected and that he had in his house. That was a very, very interesting project.
In 2022, Cycle 30 was re-released. That was the record that represented, I think, the emblem of techno music from the point of view of DJ on a side, but also from the point of view of the concept of time and space. The mastering technique of the engineer Ron Murphy, who unfortunately passed away a few years ago, and who gave shape to Detroit techno, was able to create that kind of perfect loop. I think Cycle 30 is a kind of fetish for many DJs, not only for the symbolic level of the tree trunk rings present in the cover, but really as a medium. From the mediological point of view, it seems precisely the exemplary object in which techno music demonstrates its very close connection with technology. I mean, in an object, you can feel that there is the idea of techno, the concept of locked groove, space and time, and the technology to do that.
Right. We were really lucky to find, it was just by chance that we found some unfinished pressing stampers that we were actually able to press. I think it was only 600 extra copies before the stampers became ineffective and had to discard them. So we were able to release it for our 30th anniversary. But the project, I think it was released in 96, I think, 1996.
Four.
Was it four? Okay, yeah 1996. I'm sorry. It was a time I was just in, I moved to Chicago from New York. Was in a city where I really did not know many people. I had lots of time. And I was in museums and bookstores all the time. It's where I stayed all the time. And so, also at the same time, I was having really deep conversations, I remember, with Robert Hood at the time, about minimalism and about different takes on what we can do with electronic music. At the time, let me just say that there was really a thirst for new perspectives on electronic music. We were very much interested in creating something new. So I was looking for anything, watching films, reading books, doing many different things, trying to make me think differently about why I should make music. It wasn't just for the dance floor, but I was pondering on what the future might hold for this genre, you know? I mean, I had made lock grooves before. I had made lock grooves for X102 when I was with Underground Resistance.
Yeah.
So I was aware of that. And so by the time I got to Cycle 30, I must have been very confident and had a very good idea why I should make these loops on the backside of this record and why I should call it Cycle 30. And why I should say that or remind people that trends typically repeat themselves roughly every 30 years, you know, that we tend to want to go back to the things that we remember. Also, that there are eras in our past, decades, where we have more discussion than more materialization or things that we act out, that we put into action. There are times where we put more things into action than we actually discuss and think about. And as a result, it kind of creates a wave that happens. So we talk about things, we do things. We talk about things, we do things. And that that is, and so this 30-year cycle is reflective of this wave, that there's a lot of deep discussion. It takes time to think about it, and then for people to find ways to materialize it. Once they materialize it, it makes other people think about things of how to modify it, to take it beyond. They think about it, they find a way to do it, they actually do it, right? So it takes about 30 years for that to happen. And so there's where the title comes from my research at the time back in 1994, going back about 200 years or so. I think I was going back looking at people that had very different theories, like Einstein, for instance. And then looking at when he was born, when his mother had him, when he was born. And I believe I remember looking at him and a few other scientists and very important people that created and materialized certain theories that changed the course of humanity, and looking at how old they were when they did it. And for some reason, looking at when they were born, when their parents had them when they were born. And what I found was people that tend to go on to do those things are born to mothers that are more older and more mature. It was something like being born by your mother at her age of 27, 28, maybe 30, a more mature person with more experience in life hands this experience down to their infant child. And that child has more or has a different type of degree of upbringing, because that upbringing is from someone with more knowledge. Mm-hmm. And so so that person, and so I kind of tag that somewhere around 30, I think, like 30 years. And so there's kind of where the title came from. And then I thought that I'm going to connect this to something that most of us can see. So trends, fashion, for instance, art, music, that we tend to go back to those things, and we try to remind a younger generation of what was happening 30 years ago. And so with this 30-year calculation in my head, I decided to go forward. So what could possibly be 30 years from 1994? Or what can be 30 years beyond that? And what can be? And so 30 years later, we decided to re-release this release and release only half of them. The second half of the batch, the 300 that are remaining, will be released in the year 2052. So we have them in storage, they're preserved, and then after then, that's it. So it's a very interesting project. I hope that I'm still around in 2052, but if not, we have prepared the distribution or the sale of those, or the offering of those units for that time. So,
thank you. Okay, this will be the last question. Well, in this way, we can go deeper and better understand your perspective and your vision. This question is about the fact that in this period, there is a great need to historicize techno. There are exhibitions dedicated to this. There are books, documentaries, films made by producers and DJs that take stock of what has happened in these 30 years, trying to give shape to this history. Do you think, do we really need this now, the history of techno? Or are there other scenarios to be explored in electronic music rather than create this sort of museification?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, well, my opinion, and it's my opinion only, might be kind of disappointing to some folks, but I think that what these exhibitions and what these museums and shows might display is that we did not materialize enough the opportunities that we had or have seriously enough to create enough to convincingly make these type of shows. This is just my opinion. I mean, we only made dance music. Dance music is great. It's wonderful. It's a whole culture.
Yeah.
But as a community of producers, we didn't create enough other examples of how wonderful this genre of music could be. We just partied, and we just partied. That's all that we really do. We don't. Escapism is great. Using music to create a barrier, a safe place on the dance floor, detached from the real world for a few hours is wonderful. But there were so many other things that we can address with this music that we don't do. It's not that we can't do it. It's just that there are too many of us that feel that don't think it's important enough to spend time to create, to address things that are happening around us or things that we're heading towards in terms of a species, a society. There are problems that we're having that sometimes we should not ignore them, but we should address them. And I don't mean that, we need to go out in the street and cut all the electric lines and block all the freeways and things like that. But like in other genres and other eras, we should use our art form to address how we feel about certain things that are happening. Yeah, it can be danceable, vinyl versus CD, whatever, but we should use our art form to address certain things that are happening to us, around us, for us. And we don't do that enough. I mean, I've been to a few fairs. I don't think they address, in fact, I know that they don't address what very much needs to be addressed with the genre. So making electronic music for the sake of making electronic music is okay. It's fine. 40 plus years old. I mean, this genre has been around. We've seen things come and go. Some things are new, most things are not. We avoid deep conversations, unfortunately, too often. We lack the maturity, unfortunately, to have balanced conversations about things that are important for all of us, not just certain amount of people, not the lucky ones that can make it into a club in the middle of the night. What I'm trying to say is that electronic music can enlighten people more than just the dance floor. We can use it to say things to people that might help them. My feeling is that we don't want to do that. We want to keep it for a certain group of people and away from other people. We don't want to help. By doing that, we will eventually kill it. If we don't address simple things like making the same track over and over again 200 times, right? When you could have made 200 different things, right? That would have went in 200 different directions and spoken to perhaps maybe 200 different people. There are some issues that I think that work against the idea of public display, exhibitions and things. I see the biggest problem is that the producers don't explore enough, and the media and the journalism of our genre don't challenge the producers enough and don't keep up a certain level of quality for the genre, we accept everything. That's okay, that's great. But when we need to target in on what is good quality in comparison to other genres, no one seems to have an answer for that. And so the exhibitions that I've seen are the display of things that we use to make music, but there's no discussion about why we make music, and there's no discussion about what the ideas and concepts and discussions were before you sat down to press power on your machine. What were you thinking about, and what were you trying to say, and did those things come into fruition, and did they materialize, and what happened as a result of that? There's no discussion to that. It's just the display of machines that we use. And that's really about it. And that's just a small percentage of the process of making music. And so I hope that in time there are, shows and exhibitions that speak more about the theory about electronic music and explains why it's so different from other genres, why it's different from jazz, why it's different from classical. Why has it survived this long? What are the elements that keeps it to a certain level? Has a lot of it died away, and will it eventually just completely just die away in some foreseeable future? Possibly. Taking a more analytical look at it, the genre, and not just machines, and glorifying buttons and knobs and you know what I'm talking about, right? We've done that for 40 years. Now it's time to think about what electronic music is going to give to the future. If it's nothing, then we don't need these fairs. I totally agree. Maybe it's too early. Maybe it's for someone else to do. Maybe it's I don't know. Maybe it just becomes something else. To answer the question bluntly, no, I don't think that it's justified to have shows when electronic music hasn't produced enough different ideas to support the shows.
Thank you very much, Jeff.
Thank you, Claudia. Thank you very much. And it's wonderful to see you again.